Cincinnati, this is Buddy Merriam, and you're listening to Bluegrass Time on WUSB 90.1 FM. You can tune in every Wednesday evening from 6:30 to 8 p.m. to hear some of the world's best music, bluegrass. That's 90 minutes of bluegrass from the first generation masters like Phil Monroe, Flatten Scruggs, and the Stanley Brothers, to new releases by contemporary bluegrass artists, live in the studio performances, interviews, and concert listings at 7 o'clock. That's every Wednesday night from 6:30 to 8 for Bluegrass Time on WUSB Stony Brook.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook, New York. The time is just about 6 o'clock, and that means, once again, it's time for another exciting edition of Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Manuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. As the studios continue to bake, unbelievable. Must be about 95 degrees in here. That's fine. That's fine. We're not going to complain anymore. Just going to grin and bear it. We're back. Back live. Back on the air. Live people in the studio in this radio station as opposed to all the other ones you listen to on other frequencies. Did anybody catch Channel 7 going off the air the other night? That was really cool. I just happened to have the TV on, and I noticed that, hey, there was nothing coming over the television set. This was a couple of nights ago. It was right at the 11 o'clock news, which I don't watch, but just so happened to have it on at that point. And I have this remarkable device known as TiVo, so it allows you to rewind, and I was able to see exactly the point where they went off the air, which was precisely at the moment of the 11 o'clock news. And apparently what happened was there was some kind of a fire in their studio, and on cable and over the air, there was just a dead signal. On the satellite system, though, they got so many phone calls, they had to put up a little notice saying, don't call us, we know they're off the air, there's nothing we can do about it. And then, finally, after several hours, they came back on the air, and you know what? They said nothing. They didn't say a word about it. The reason for that is because there were no people in the studio. It's all run by computers. So the program that was supposed to air just started playing, and the commercials that went with it just started playing as well, and there was no friendly announcer voice to say, sorry, folks, for the inconvenience, we were off the air, but everything's fine now. They don't have that anymore. I don't know how many of you even remember when they did have that, but they used to be announcers on every radio station, on every TV station, and you'd always be able to know what was going on. And you'd know what time it was, and it just was, it had this kind of human touch. Nowadays, TV networks are literally workstations. They're just little boxes, little computers. And, for instance, if you're watching Discovery Insect, or whatever channel they put on the air recently, that is not a channel. There are now people running around saying, hey, we got to get this program on the air and hold the presses. We have a bulletin. No, it's just it's a series of files playing, and the commercials are other files playing, and there's no passion, there's no spirit, there's no soul. But here, at non-commercial radio stations such as this one, there are people, human beings, in the studio that answer the phone, that speak into the microphone live. Yes, it's 6.05 p.m. on Tuesday evening, May 29th, thank you, May 29th, and we have imperfections of all sorts. I just hit the microphone with my hand. You can't do that in commercial radio because there are no people, for one thing, but even if there were people there, perfection is demanded, and perfection sucks. I'm sorry, I just had to say that. That's what's going on in the world of radio these days. Not a whole lot unless you listen to non-commercial radio. And if you're listening to non-commercial radio, you're doing that for a purpose. You're doing that for a reason. And if you feel like listening to commercial radio, you might as well just be playing with your own iPod or CD random shuffler or whatever. All the fun has gone out of it. It really has. We had a show last week, a special show from North Korea last week when I was in Kaesong, the... it's not the border town, but it's very close to the border town. It was another city besides Pyongyang, and we will be doing a show from Pyongyang in the future. And we got some feedback. I'm actually surprised. I expected to get more feedback from people out there. I don't know if you're afraid to email us because we were talking from North Korea, and you think maybe the government will take your email and read it and write something down about you. You know what? So what if they do? So what if they do? Just go ahead and write that email. Let us know what... And you can say bad things to us, too. You can say, my God, Emmanuel, you commie, how dare you go to North Korea and associate with those people who actually say nasty things to us sometimes and don't do everything George W. Bush says. You can say that. You can criticize us. We're perfectly okay with that. But we do want to hear what you think. It's not every day that you hear radio shows from North Korea. It really isn't. In fact, I don't think we've ever done that before, ever, anywhere. But who knows? If there are other radio shows that did that, I'd like to know about them. But we did get a comment, and I'd like to read that. We got a few comments, but this is one of them. Dear Emmanuel, first off, thanks for your work. While I don't fire up the shortwave receiver much these days, the computer feed of your shows works well here in the media white space of North Florida. Of course, this show is no longer broadcast on shortwave, but Off the Hook is. I have a couple of comments regarding the recent recording you released of your trip to North Korea. First off, I'm wondering if anyone has examined the digital signal that is playing under the Korean station ID that you played during the opening. It sounded a lot like an old RTTY signal. I suspect that among your listeners, there's someone who has the proper gizmo to decode this. Well, okay, let me just right now explain how that actually happened. You're referring to when we were playing the shortwave interval signal right before the broadcast of the program. A confession I have to make, that is not my recording. That is something that I got off a website that just had the Voice of Korea interval signal and greeting, opening greeting. It was a good way to open the show and also a good way to close the show. And what we had to do, because that RTTY noise was so loud and dominant, we actually had to splice together a couple so that you'd hear the interval signal and then you'd hear a greeting in English, because otherwise you would have heard a greeting in Portuguese or something that had a better sound. So you hear RTTY noise. It's not coming from Voice of Korea. It's coming from some other interference on shortwave, and it's not anything recent. It's at least 5 or 6 years old, maybe even older than that. So go ahead, translate it if anyone out there is able to. I'd like to know. But it could mean anything. RTTY signals are pretty cool, and I know a lot of people are into shortwave still to this day. Second, I wanted to share a story about a trip I recently took to Japan that has a parallel to your going to the bar across the river story. I was in Japan last month officially to do a service call on a friend's MacBook, which is a long story in and of itself, but in reality as a chance to experience as much of the culture as possible in 2 weeks. I was mostly traveling solo during this time, and one day was exploring the Nippori district of Tokyo. It's an area of the city that doesn't have the skyscrapers and neon that we associate with Tokyo, and instead has small houses and shops along narrow, winding streets. Kind of a cool place, I imagine. I was walking down one of those narrow streets, just exploring and seeing what kind of trouble I could get into, when over my head there was a loud squawk sound as a Japanese raven or crow dumped a goose egg-sized turd on my jacket sleeve. That is incredible, because that's almost exactly what happened, minus the squawk. That's almost exactly what happened to me in Kaesong, North Korea. It was at night, but and it was recorded as you heard it last week. You heard the whole thing happen, and when we had to wash it off, and it was quite an adventure. But the most interesting part about that adventure, though, was the fact that we were unattended and walking around Kaesong in North Korea and actually getting lost at one point and going into the wrong rooms. Anyway, continuing with this letter. So here I was in an unfamiliar culture with a big wet bird turd on my sleeve and no clue about how to deal with it. As I stood there looking at the turd, an older gentleman, and this is a very appropriate term, came out of his shop a few doors down, talking to me in Japanese, way past my 8-word vocabulary. He pulled me down the street, made a gesture that I understood to mean, wait here, and scurried off into his shop. It's always good to have the gesture, wait here, understood in many cultures. He appeared a few seconds later with a chair. He took my backpack, sat me down, and made the wait gesture again. What is the wait gesture exactly? I guess just holding two hands and sort of backing up. Anyway, he scurried off into his shop again. He returned with a stack of wet white washcloths and waited while I removed the turd. I thanked him as well. You can say turd on the air, can't you? All right, I think you can. I thanked him as well as I could in Japanese, doing the bowing thing and saying, Sima masen? I know arigato is thank you. Sima masen? Anyone in the studio know what that means? No? Okay. As I put on my backpack and walked away, he trotted out 3 words of English and said, damn Japanese crow. Yeah. I don't know if the story has any more of a moral than yours did, but wanted to share that this is a very small world, and to paraphrase Woody Guthrie, there are more birdie turds than one. Thanks, Dave, for writing in with that. That's definitely a classic story there, and proof that there is harmony in the world and birds dropping crap on us all over the place. And it happened to George W. Bush, too. Did you see this? He was giving a press conference. I think it was at the White House. I forget who he was. He was embarrassing this time. But as he's speaking to the press, you just see this thing appear on his sleeve all of a sudden. And he's not aware of it, but then after a couple of seconds, he sees it and he starts wiping it off with his hand. And it's really kind of disgusting. I mean, he didn't know what it was at the time, I guess, but he found out pretty quickly. But, yeah, apparently that is the theme of the week, is birds letting loose on humans. But there are more serious things going on, definitely. For instance, there are letters. Okay, here's a letter. Actually, we have a guest I want to introduce, but let me read this letter first, and then maybe I'll get his comments on this as well. This is from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, dated Monday, April 16, 2007. There's all this talk about the extra month of daylight savings time and the controversy it's causing. And this person named Connie Meskimen of Hot Springs, Arkansas, wrote in with her feelings on the whole thing. You may have noticed that March of this year was particularly hot. As a matter of fact, I understand that it was the hottest March since the beginning of the last century. All of the trees were fully leafed out, and legions of bugs and snakes were crawling around during a time in Arkansas when, on a normal year, we might see a snowflake or two. This should come as no surprise to any reasonable person. As you know, daylight savings time started almost a month early this year. You would think that members of Congress would have considered the warming effect that an extra hour of daylight would have on our climate. Or did they? Perhaps this is another plot by, liberal Congress to make us believe that global warming is a real threat. Perhaps next time there should be serious studies performed before Congress passes laws with such far-reaching effects. Now, it's I show this letter to quite a few people. I've shown it to quite a few people, and a lot of people don't seem to think there's anything funny about it or anything crazy about it. But this person actually believes that having daylight savings time increases the amount of daylight on the planet. And I don't know if the person wrote this as a joke or if someone actually believes that. And with that, I'd like to introduce Lurid from Ohio, who's on the telephone right now. Are you on the telephone with us?
I am, in fact, on the telephone. How are you doing?
Okay. Good to hear from you. And for those of you astute listeners who have been paying attention, Lurid was on the show a year ago out in Dayton when we were at the Waffle House. And that was a fun time then, and we did it again recently.
Yeah, we did. It was a good time, as usual.
It was a lot of fun. Now, you just heard this letter from Arkansas I read on the Gazette or whatever it's called.
Yeah, I did. That's I don't really know what to say about that. That's kind of seems to me to be hilarious and kind of ridiculous, but I don't know.
Well, do you think the person writing it thought it was funny or thought it was real?
It has to be a joke. I mean, honestly, I mean, you know, I don't think that there's some plot to you know, get us to think that there's, you know, to convince us of global warming any more than I don't know. It's just, it seems crazy to me.
Well, I mean, 10 years ago I would have agreed wholeheartedly, but these days, you know, people believe all sorts of things and buy into all sorts of theories that would be laughed hysterically at a decade ago, or certainly 2 decades ago. So I don't know. I don't know. There might be a lot of people who believe this. There certainly are a lot of people who believe that global warming is a myth. They're still out there.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, Lurid, you've got some interesting stories, being from Ohio, I guess, totally different culture. I always get a kick out of going out there for the Hamvention, which is in May. And what we do is we drive the 2600 van out. In fact, I don't know how I pulled it off this year, but I went out there with the van and pretty much drove all night through Wheeling, West Virginia, all the way into Ohio. And that's where I met up with you. But somehow I was able to do that on no sleep, and driving the 2600 van is no easy task. But it's always an adventure. The Hamventions. Can you describe it to people who may never have seen one?
Well, Hamvention, I mean, essentially what it is this arena that we have where we used to have a hockey team that would play here. It's still used for concerts and, you know, wrestling, you know, that on the WWE stuff and, I mean, all kinds of things and a lot of... you know, like we have something else called Computer Fest, which is similar, where everybody just kind of sells their goods. Hamvention, a giant parking lot where each parking space is occupied by a tent of some kind, and people bring anything that they think that they can sell to people that are interested in ham radios, and you know, there's a lot of good stuff and a lot of good deals, but also, I mean, there's just some ridiculous things, you know, but I guess there are suckers out there and some people buy into it, but, you know, it's always fun. I enjoy it, you know, get to meet all kinds of different people. Cause I mean, people come to this from all over the world. You know, it's pretty cool and it's surprising how popular it is, but, you know, somehow it draws, you know, people from all over the world to Dayton, Ohio, which is...
Yeah, and I mean, you're in Dayton pretty much 365 days of the year, and those people aren't there most of those days, so what's it like then? Is it considerably less hectic and crowded?
Well, I mean, you know, generally, I mean, it is less crowded. I mean, you know, when Hamvention's in town, I mean, all the hotels are full, when generally they never are, really. I mean, you know, traffic is generally worse, you know, during the hours of, you know, of operation for Hamvention. So, you know, it's pretty crazy, but I like having all the different people around. It brings some culture to this, you know, area where everybody's seems to be pretty narrow-minded, so it's kind of a breath of fresh air.
I mean, there is narrow-mindedness, but the people I meet at these things, they seem to be a lot more open than I would expect, and that's also a cool thing. And I realized this when I was there. This came to me that it was going to Dayton year after year and meeting with people in the Midwest who I really grew to like and admire. That's what sort of got me into the spirit of going to a place like North Korea, because it was a completely different environment where there are human beings that believe in different things than I do. And I think it's that kind of willingness to expose yourself to a different culture that we could all use a little bit more of, instead of just assuming we know how things are. And this is true of the left and the right, where people just know their way, and they don't want to see anybody from any other point of view because they know how they think, and there's nothing they can possibly say to them. And that is just so untrue and so damaging.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. It's, you know, I also think it's good because, you know, for people that are, you know, that have a problem, you know, accepting other people's point of views, it kind of helps people to open up a little bit, because the people that are there are all generally there for, you know, a common purpose, and that's, I should say a common interest, and that's, you know, ham radios and technology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that seems to be a good, I guess, you know, icebreaker for conversation starting, and you know, it's a good time. It really is.
And it's so interesting, too. This is just indicative of how small a world it is. I first met you at one of the Hope conferences in New York. You had come there to volunteer. You were on the security team and doing a fine job. And we got to talking about one thing or another. And then it turned out you're from Dayton, which is where I go once a year. And you knew some of the same people I knew. And it was just kind of a small world type of a thing. So we've kept in touch throughout the years on those two levels, Hope in New York and the Hamvention in Dayton. So that's kind of cool right there and then. But also what has happened over the years, I've been sort of following your saga. You have a saga. Not everybody has a saga, but you definitely have a saga. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree. There's definitely a story or two that I could tell, I would say. But, a saga, yeah, I guess.
I mean, you're someone who's, I think, very open-minded, certainly for the Midwest, and I, one of the conversations I had with you, we were just talking about music and politics and things like that, and I was amazed how somebody could become so enlightened in the Midwest. I mean, maybe that's not being fair to the people there. Maybe it's not so difficult to open yourself up to alternative thoughts and ideas and not just believe everything that you're told. Would you say a lot of people are like that out there?
Yeah, actually, I mean, a lot of people are, and don't get me wrong, I mean, sometimes, you know, when I talk about, you know, Ohio, it might seem like, you know, all I say is that there's just, it's horrible people, but I mean, that's not really true. I mean, there's good people everywhere you go, mm-hmm. I think, but, you know, it just seems that around here, it's just, you know, like you just said, I mean, people are very, very, seem to be very close-minded, mm-hmm. and, you know, it stinks. It's kind of sad, but, you know, we got to deal with it.
It's also inspirational when I see people coming out of small towns or really distant parts of the country who are still able to learn about the same things and be exposed to, you know, people like Jello Biafra without coming to the conference, hearing words of alternative thought. I think that's always something I admire so much, because it's got to be harder when you're in, say, a small town in Idaho or something, and you're just learning about all of this and somehow connecting. I guess the internet helps too. You're connecting with all these people with similar mindsets. But with regards to what you're facing right now, and this is, I guess, we're kind of jump into the story. You're facing going to prison in a couple of days because of a series of what I consider to be really kind of bizarre events. And I think the reason I'm interested in telling this story is because I think this happens to a lot of people. I think a lot of people are going through what you're going through, where basically just one thing happens on top of another thing, on top of another thing, and the powers that be lose sight of what we're really talking about in the first place. I think that's what happened with Kevin Mitnick. I think that's what happened with Bernie S. And these are just, yours is not a hacking case, but those are hacking cases. I think if you look at the justice system, you'll find a predominance of cases like this where something fairly trivial happened, and you just keep building upon that. And before you know it, you've painted somebody as a criminal, and that's how society will see them for the rest of their lives. And these days, more than ever before, I think we are very quick and eager to jump into that that mindset and just condemn people. You jaywalked, oh my God, you're a criminal, go to jail. And our prisons are overcrowded, filled with people. And hang on, I'm getting a call from somebody. Apparently, there's no one on the air. Sorry about that. And basically, you fall into a mindset, and anything, any transgression at all, is considered worthy of the most severe punishment. And I'm scared. You know, people say we are a nation of laws. I don't know what that means. You ever hear that phrase? The politicians love to say that.
Oh yeah.
And it's just this crazy phrase. I guess it means that whatever you do, we're going to get you for it. But to get to your story, it all started when a car you were in was pulled over. Is that right?
Yeah.
And this was what year?
Let's see. This had been 2004.
It was that recent, 2004?
2003, maybe.
Okay, 2003. Okay, so you're in a car, and tell us as briefly as possible what the story was.
Well, Paul, I'm sorry, you're breaking up a little bit.
As quickly as possible, what happened in that car? What did they get you for?
Well, okay, essentially what happened was I'd gotten pulled over. It was about 2 in the morning, so, you know, it looked bad.
You looked bad because you got pulled over at 2 in the morning?
Well, I mean, cars out. This is a place called Yellow Springs, which is, you know, it's where, you know, where Dave Chappelle's from. It's a little village. It's the village of Yellow Springs. To make a long story even longer, I'm driving at, I don't know, it's about 2 in the morning. I got off work at 1, and I went to pick a friend up, you know, to go get some coffee, and he had some people over to his place, and, you know, I
you're right,
him
this is looking really,
have me
this looking really bad.
My home. Well, as I'm pulling out, I'm illegally stopped in the first place, and it was completely bogus, but that's a whole other story that's really not that important.
What do you mean by you were illegally stopped? Can't they just stop you whenever they want?
I mean, they accused me of running a stop sign, and I didn't, and it was completely obvious that I didn't. But
they lied. The cops lied.
Well, yeah, essentially, yeah. They lied.
That's totally legal.
It was bogus. You know, I was stopped, and the cops stopped when he didn't have a stop sign and flashed his lights for me to go, and he got behind me and pulled me over.
Okay, that's what cops do. They lie all the time. I think it's even allowed.
Yeah, no, it is. No.
Okay, so they stop you. You're stopped. All right, fine. So what happens then?
Well, as soon as we get stopped, a guy in the back seat opens the door, and he takes off running. So I don't know this person, which my first mistake was ever letting anybody in the car that I didn't know.
Okay.
He was a friend of a friend. But anyway, he takes off, and nothing's really done about that. They ask about his identity, and nobody seems to know anything about him. All they know is his nickname, and you know, blah blah blah. But anyway, they stop me, and they're like, you almost hit me there, and. They tell me that they smell like drugs have been smoked in the car, and that was completely bogus. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just complete nonsense, he said that, and I told him, well, you're wrong, and he didn't seem to even mention that again. But, I was 18 at the time, and there was a couple other – I just turned 18, too, which kind of made it worse. It stunk.
Right.
You know, there ends up being, and there's other kids that are, you know, young as well. And they tell me that they want to search my car. And, you know, I ask them, I was like, well, if I tell you no, you're just going to, you know, tell me that you have probable cause and do it anyway. And it's just going to take more time. So, you know, go for it.
Well, I mean, that's what they'll use, the smell. They'll say the smell is probable cause. So then that gives us the right to search. Okay.
So, you know, I just said, go ahead. So we started searching the car, and, the searches forever, and in the back seat he finds a baggie with some kind of residue on it, just shoved in the back passenger seat. And next thing I know, I'm in the station, and I'm being interrogated, and they're trying to get me to lie, and they're trying to tell me that I'm lying, and they're trying to get me to stumble over my own words to. You know, they're trying to convince me that I'd done something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, obviously having, you know, somebody in my car that, you know, once again, it goes back to that, having somebody in my car that I didn't know, that's, you know, the first mistake. But, you know, anyway, and next thing I know, you know, I'm being interrogated, and, very intimidating, too. It was very scary. I don't scare easily, you know, and that was very, very... it was a very scary thing.
Well, I mean, I can attest to that. I haven't been through anything compared to what you've been through, but just the time that I was in custody in that period at the Republican convention when they swept people off the street, and I was in prison for jail, for 36 hours with 1,000 other people, it was still so intimidating that I wasn't even able to, like, walk on the same side of the street as police when I saw them coming down the street for a couple of weeks, probably.
Yeah.
And I notice when I'm with you that you sort of have the same kind of reaction that when you see cops coming, you're kind of very wary of them. And it's got nothing to do with being guilty. It's got to do with being traumatized.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, in my situation, you know, I hadn't done anything wrong. And, you know, and it's just they've got it in my mind. And, you know, as I tell the story, it'll, you know, become more clear
mm-hmm.
you know, why I panic anytime I see anything. But, you know, they do their best at convincing you that you're a criminal. And I don't know if it's working on me or not, but, you know, anytime I see, you know, I see cops coming, you know, I sure as heck don't go out of my way to say hello to them.
Right,
or
right.
That, you know.
So, okay, so you're in the station, they've got a plastic bag they found in the back seat of your car. Where are all the other people that were in your car, by the way?
I guess they got taken to the lobby and they got questioned and, you know, and they were telling the police officers that, you know, that he's not a bad kid, you know, he's a good person, he, you know, he's never been in, you know, and I'd never been in trouble before in my life, you know, no felonies, no juvenile record. You know, nothing.
You jaywalk, though. I think I heard somebody say that once.
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay, so it sounds like you're being held responsible for the baggie they found in the car, which obviously could have come from anybody who was sitting in the car.
Right, and the other thing is that the car wasn't even registered in my name.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and but I was driving. And, you know, that's the law, and that's something that I'd like to convey to people is, you know, as much as possible is that, you know, if you're driving the car, you are responsible for everything that happens in it by law.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, if somebody drives by and you have your window down, they throw a baggie in your car with something illegal on it as they drive by and you get stopped, it's in your car.
Yeah.
You know, and the cops aren't going to, even if they got it on video, you know, that they see this person throwing this into your car, they're not going to care to go back and look. They've got you, and that's the easiest thing for them to do because all they want is to prosecute somebody so they can get paid. Because, I mean, I've paid, you know, at least $7,000 in court costs and fines and supervision fees and
mm-hmm.
and all kinds of stuff for this. And it's not just me. I mean, it's thousands and thousands of people, a month. A 1,000 people a month. I mean, it's insane how much money they get out of these people. That's what they want. It's all about money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
when you,
know,
say,
it's,
when you say 1,000 people a month, where are you referring to?
Well, I mean, honestly, I mean, that statistic might not be exact, but I mean, I know that it's a ridiculous amount. And, you know, some places more than others.
But which place are you referring to when you say 1,000 a month?
Well, the place, Greene County. Which
just
is,
okay, so it's just your local area. You're saying 1,000 people a month. That's
well, the area, the county that's, you know, right next to the one that I live in,
mm-hmm.
and it's just, yeah, and it's insane, you
okay.
know, and it's all for, and it's mostly for petty stuff too,
right,
like,
right.
You know, possession of drugs or something, you know, and
mm-hmm.
it just seems like it's a horrible waste of. You know, of our police force. I mean,
well, I mean, I think possession of drugs is a fairly petty crime and something that doesn't tend to harm anybody other than the person who is using it, but obviously it can lead to other worse things.
Right.
But in your particular case, you claim it wasn't even yours in the first place. I mean, what bothers me is our prisons are filled with people who have been through something like this, where either they're in possession of something they're not supposed to have, or they are in the wrong place at the wrong time and have to take responsibility for something that wasn't theirs. And meanwhile, you have all these violent thugs walking around that somehow are able to stay out of any kind of confinement. I mean, that's if you're going to have prisons, those are the people to put there, the violent people, the people who are actually a threat to those around them, the people who, you know, commit gun crimes and threaten people and just make us all feel unsafe. Those are the people you got to watch out for. And what I see instead, I see, you know, over 2 million people in prison that really most of them shouldn't be there. Most of them can probably be helped on the outside and be living fruitful lives. Instead, it's, you know, lives are being destroyed as a result of this.
Right. And, I mean, you know, you know, logically, you know, if you're that worried about drugs, you would go after the drug dealers, the big drug dealers, you know,
mm-hmm.
but they don't do that because, you know, that's, it's easier for them. They can get more money, you know, they bust the little person who's consuming the drugs. That's, you know, in my case, you know, they charge me $7,000, you know, in fines and such. And, you know, if this drug dealer is selling to hundreds of people, you know, that's, they can get every one of those people and just let this, you know, this drug dealer do all the work for them to get them the money to get them into trouble. So, you know, they don't go after them, which, you know, it's,
mm-hmm.
it's sad.
Yeah, it is. It's extremely sad. So you're in the system now, and I take it you were prosecuted for this. And what did you wind up being sentenced to?
Well, I got I was convicted of I ended up being convicted of 8 felonies, which all of them were for this baggie, and then there was like something in the bag and something else, and there was multiple like little pieces of paper in the bag, and they turned each one of those pieces of paper into a possession charge and a criminal tool charge and all kinds of stuff. So I was convicted of eight fifth degree felonies, and they each hold 11 months in prison.
Okay.
So you know, after I was convicted, they put me on probation, where, you know, everything was good. And then, the first thing, leaving the county without permission, I got violated on that and had to do jail time.
Now, when you say you got violated, that means that's a violation of your probation.
Correct, yeah. You now have to go in front of a judge again. This racks up more court costs and fines every time you go into it. And so they separate into three different hearings. You've got your probable cause hearing. This is when the probation officer has gone to the judge and said, hey, this person has violated terms of their what they call community control sanctions. And so I'm summoned to come to court and, you know, hope to God that you can afford a paid attorney, because a public pretender is not going to do anything for you.
Right.
So you go in there with your lawyer, and then, you know, you either discuss, discuss the probable cause, why the probation officer is going to do what's called revoking your probation. And that's the first step. Second step is what's called an evidentiary hearing. And this is where they, once again, go over the reasons why you're being revoked, and it seems to be the exact same thing as a probable cause hearing, but it's just another excuse to get you into the courtroom to get some more money out of you.
Uh-huh.
And then third, you go up for what's called the revocation hearing, and that's where you are sentenced to, you know, whatever, you know, your fate.
Because of this violation. Now, in your particular case, you said it was leaving without permission.
Right, I didn't leave the state, but I left the county. And that was a misunderstanding, actually. On reading my conditions, you know, it is my fault, but, you know, it was just a simple misunderstanding on my part. You know, as far as I've ever heard in my entire life, you know, I've heard you can't leave the state or the country that you're in,
mm-hmm.
Without permission. And, you know, I was like, okay, that's cool. So I went to volunteer at what's called Ohio Linux Fest, so I went out to another city and came back, and she asked me, you know, what are you doing, or what'd you do this week? And I said, I went to do this in this place. And she was like, oh, you know, and next thing I know, I'm in court. So, yeah, that's how I got revoked.
And that's because
you
misread it as instead of state and country.
Sorry, I got off topic. County. It actually said county, not country.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So one letter.
And the even more ridiculous thing about it is I live in a different county than the county that I was being, you know, prosecuted in. So I don't understand.
Well, how does that work then? Are you not allowed to go home?
Apparently. So, upon further, you know, after I discovered that I'd made this error, You know, I talked this over with the probation department, and they said that I'm only allowed to go to, you know, Montgomery County and Greene County, which are the two counties that, you know, I live in and the county has been prosecuted in.
Okay. Now, the story doesn't end there, of course. This was the first time that something like this happened. There were numerous times where they accused you of taking drugs, and you were basically just thrown into jail without a moment's notice, right?
Right. So I have, you know, on probation, as, you know, most anybody that's been on felony probation can tell you, you have pretty much a weekly drug test. It's a urinalysis. You know, you go into a room, and you have this generally big, huge guy standing not 2 feet away from you. You have to face him, and you have to pull your pants all the way down. And he looks down at your naughty no-no place, and very awkward. And, I mean, talk about having a shy bladder. And then, you know, they get even more mad at you when you can't, you know, urinate on a moment's notice while there's another male watching you,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, anyway. So you go in, you do that, and then they put the little test strip in the cup with your urine, and you sit there and you wait. And you wait. And for somebody who doesn't do drugs, it seems like it wouldn't be a big deal. Just be like, oh, okay, and well, that's what I thought. And next thing I know, it's coming up positive for methamphetamines, which you know, that's beyond me. And I told them, I said, this is completely, completely bogus. Like, what is wrong with you? Test me again. And then they test me again, and they test me again, and it keeps coming up positive. I have not ingested any drugs, okay? So, and I'm trying to tell them this, and they're just getting in my face, yelling at me. Next thing I know, I've got probation officers that aren't even my probation officer coming out, yelling at me, telling me that I'm guilty, and they keep shoving this piece of paper in my face, saying to confess my guilt. You know, they asked me to make a written statement saying that I have ingested this drug, and that it's in my best interest to do, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I never did. I told them, I said, you can kiss my bottom. And you know, and luckily I know that any test like that, you know, it's given by the government, you have the right to you know, to challenge that by having it sent to a lab. And generally what you, if you can, have it sent to an independent lab, not their lab. But anyway, that wasn't in that wasn't a choice for me. I had to send it to their lab, which the first time that I sent it, the woman's like, I have no idea how much it cost. Hold on. And then she comes out and gets some random number, tells me it's $40 to send my urine to a lab. So I go down, pay this $40, and then, well, I'm in cuffs the whole time. So, you know, they're signing all the papers, and they're signing everything for me, and I have to watch, you know. And they seal it up, put it in a box, and send it, and I get taken to jail.
Right, and you're paying $40 while your hands are cuffed together get this test.
What I ended up having to do, luckily I had, at that time, I had exactly $40 in my pocket at that time, and I had my probation officer, well, not mine, but a probation officer took me down there, and he was nice enough to get it out of my pocket and hand it to the clerk of courts for me.
That was very nice of him.
And that was... So that was awful mighty wide of them, I thought. But
and so then what happens with the test results?
Well, it takes up to 2 weeks to get that back, and I wait in jail for 2 weeks. You know, it can actually take up to a month. But in this particular situation, it took about a week.
Uh-huh.
Actually, it was 9 days. And 9 days later, I randomly one morning and woke up in my cell block, and woke up from my let's just say it's the most comfortable bed in the entire planet, and I was very upset to leave it. That's sarcasm.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, and they tell me to leave, and I'm out, and then I have to report to the probation officer immediately after leaving jail. So now I'm scattering around. They won't let me use the phone, so I'm walking miles to find somewhere to use a payphone, and I'm asking people for change. And anyway, I go and I talk to the probation officer, and she just kind of pretends like nothing ever happened.
Hmm.
Like she's being much nicer to me than she normally is, but she she's pretended that nothing happened. You know, not even a, oh, I'm sorry that I doubted you. Yeah, okay, there we made a mistake. You know, nothing. And
but that is what happened. That's why you were released.
Yeah, I was released because my drug results came back. Now, I mean, to be honest with you, I've never seen a result, or even they've never even spoken about drug test results. But I mean, obviously, you know, why else would I be released from jail?
Uh-huh.
So,
now, how many times has something similar happened in the last couple of years?
In 1 year, it happened 3 times.
3 times you were just thrown in jail because they didn't like the test results?
No, for 9 days at a time.
And each time you were vindicated?
Yeah.
And did you ever get an apology of any sort?
Not once.
Unbelievable.
Not once. And, you know, like I said, not once did I ever see a piece of paper with a result on it. You know, nothing. And, in fact, the first time that it happened, there was talk and rumors that the result came back, but the probation officer didn't really care to present that to anybody. And, you know, as soon as I was released, and I was released by a different probation officer than mine, and the next thing I know, her office is cleared out, she's fired, and I have a new PO.
But your troubles didn't end there, because now you're facing more prison time, or actual real prison time, as opposed to being... Were you in a prison, or were you just in a jail?
I was locked up in the county jail, which, I mean, county jail and jail, I mean, I don't... a lot of people have, you know, misconceptions about prison and what's jail and what's not. And, you know, just to clarify, jail is actually for felons, and a fifth-degree felony is the smallest felony, and that holds a minimum of 11 months. So,
mm-hmm.
Essentially, you have to... You, to go to prison, really, you have to be convicted of a fifth-degree felony, and it's generally 11 months.
Okay, so now you're facing now, this week actually, being sentenced to what kind of time are we looking at?
Well, anywhere from 11 to 88 months. But,
oh, my God.
You know, I since this is, you know, the only thing that I've ever, you know, been, you know, I've ever gotten in trouble for, you know, most people will get their stuff, you know, run together, so...
But, right, I mean, when you say got in trouble for it, basically we're going back to the plastic bag in the back of the car that didn't belong to you in the first place.
Right, and this is, you know, years later.
It's like that poem, The House That Jack Built or something, where it just keeps getting crazier and crazier. But now this particular time, and we're almost out of time, because I hope we can finish the whole story, but this all came about as a result of... I guess, misunderstood information from the probation officer or a change of story on their part. You went to visit your mother.
Correct.
And apparently you weren't supposed to do that without getting a particular form, which they told you you didn't need at the time. Is that how it worked?
Well, what actually ended up happening was I had been, you know, telling my probation officer, well, it's at the probation officer's, you know, it's her decision whether or not I'm allowed to leave and go. And, you know, I'd been doing everything that I was supposed to do on probation. You know, I have to pay a $50 a month supervision fee. You know, I pay that on time. You know, the urine tests, you know, all clean other than the ones that, you know, I sent away to labs and mysteriously everything just went away. You know, and I did everything right, you know, and I told her, I was like, well, hey, I would like to go visit my mother, whom I haven't seen in years. And, you know, she lives in another state, and, you know, she said, well, as long as you keep doing everything that you're supposed to do, everything will be fine. So, you know, I called her and told her, I was like, well, plane tickets are getting more expensive, I need to make these arrangements now. She was like, okay, go ahead. So I went ahead, and I bought the plane ticket, and I wrote her a nice email, I took a Google Earth image, you know, of the latitude and longitude of where, you know, my mother's house was, you know, the phone number of their house, their cell phone numbers, all my flight itinerary, everything. I had it in this email, and she got it, and I said, did you get my email? She said, yes, I got your email. That was very, very thorough, and kind of chuckled about it, like, you know, indicating that, you know, there was way more information than she needed. And I went. And, turns out that I needed to get a form that just that had her signature on it, you know, saying that I could go. And I come back from my trip, and I go in to see her, and I'm put in handcuffs. And that was that. And I was sent to jail, and I was released on bond, which was $25,000. And, you know, I was out for, and this is the kicker, I was out on bond for a week when I went back in for one of my drug tests, and that's when one of them said that I was positive. And so I was out on $25,000 and sent right back to jail a week later. So anyway, you know, I you know, went to see my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's not like I was, you know, and I had permission. She knew where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And
you certainly were open as far as talking about it. I guess what the only thing you could be accused of is not thoroughly understanding the rules, but it sounds like they didn't actually go out of their way to explain the rules.
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, that's all it boils down to is that, you know, I you know, misunderstood having to, you know, come in and get a piece of paper signed and the probation officer verbally telling me that I could go. I thought that was okay, but
uh-huh.
It wasn't.
It's incredible. We're talking, by the way, with Lurid from Ohio, who is facing all kinds of prison time. And what's fascinating about this story is how it all begins, how it all spins out of control. And you realize it just for having a stranger in your car that left a plastic bag with some residue of something on it, you can be categorized as a criminal. And this kind of thing can just keep happening time after time, where certain little things are added. And before long, even reasonable people portray you as somebody who just doesn't know how to stay out of trouble, someone who's a criminal who deserves to be in prison. And I find that this is kind of indicative of our society, where we just condemn people, either in large groups or as individuals, for minor transgressions or because we believe they're just incapable of doing anything else and we need this certain underclass of criminals. But when you look closer, when you look at what they actually did, what they actually accused of, what the evidence actually says, it's simply incredible what we are doing to people. We're basically destroying their lives and locking them away. And if you listen to Lurid over the last hour or so, I think you would have realized that this guy really gets it as far as being able to explain what's going on and just how the whole system works. And I really am very afraid of what would happen if you got sent away, if you would be forever scarred by something like that. And for what? For what purpose? How is society being helped by having someone like you off the streets because that plastic bag was in your car years ago and because you didn't understand the rules about visiting your mother and because they don't understand how to read a drug test and various things like that? There are real criminals out there really hurting people and causing all kinds of horrible things to happen. And either they're getting treated the same way as you or they're getting treated better than you. It's really a fouled up system in so many ways. An hour just is not enough time to do it justice.
No, and the, you know, the thing about it is that this has destroyed my life. You know, I'm 20 years old. And I'm supposed to have a whole lot to look forward to. You know, I take an interest in computers and technology, and you know, that was supposed to be good for me, that I've invested pretty much my whole life into that, and that was supposed to get me a good job, and that was supposed to do good things for me. And, you know, I finally end up landing a good job, you know, that would have been my career at age 20. This would have been amazing for me. I would have been making good money. I would have been able to start my life. You know, and it would have been perfect. It would have been the best thing that would ever have happened to me. And they go for a background check, and it comes back with these minor felonies. And you know, and the reason that they ended up background checking me is because I disappeared for a couple days because I ended up being put in jail for a false drug test. And you know, it just every time something good seems to happen, this probation or these felonies or something gets in the way, and it just will not allow me to progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with my life.
And if you start believing that, though, if you start believing that every time something good happens, something bad is going to happen to cancel it out or to set you back even further, you're in the mindset of just going down the path that they want you to go down. And they do want you to go down this path. They want you to become a criminal so that they can go and put you back in prison. And there's another statistic under their belt. They love that kind of thing. I've seen this countless times. So that's something you definitely have to be very careful of, that you don't fall into that pattern. Of course, it's a lot easier to say that than it is to live it. Every time you get a job, yeah, they're going to look up this and find these minor felonies, which I don't think you should be considered a felon at all for these things that they charged you for. They just seem incredibly circumstantial at best and false at worst.
Yeah, it really is a sad thing, you know. And I do try to remain optimistic about things, you know. But believe it or not, and it is hard sometimes. I will admit, you know, I'll be the first one to tell you that it's difficult, you know, for fear of, you know, every week when you go to see your probation officer, that drug test is going to say that you're dirty because you took cold medicine, or you know, and it's scary. But, you know, like I said, I try to remain optimistic, and I think that's something that anybody that's in this situation has to do. I mean, that's all you can do, because honestly, once you're in the system, you can't get out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And if you do, you're very, very lucky. So the only thing that you can do is remain optimistic and try to go with it, and you know, and pay attention to what's going on, and don't let these people push you around, because, I mean, believe it or not, you know, you don't have many rights, but you don't have any rights left, but you know, you do have a few, and if you pay attention to them, you know, I think you'd be better off. So.
Well, Lurid, I have to say that you've been an inspiration to many of us who happen to be, for whatever reason, on the right side of the law, but I imagine you're also an inspiration to a lot of people who find themselves in a similar predicament. I know a lot of people would definitely have given up by now, and yet you're able, you've fought so many things in your life. You've fought really serious health issues, which we're not going to get into tonight, but something that alone would be so much for somebody to get through. And you've gotten through that, you've gotten through this, you've gotten through all sorts of other challenges. And I just hope the story doesn't end when they decide what they're going to do to you for this alleged violation of your probation by visiting your mother because you misunderstood some instructions. It's just insane. It's a Kafka-ish type of a story where basically something misunderstood balloons into something that becomes a major crime, and you wind up being thought of as a criminal mastermind when in actuality you didn't do anything. And I just wonder how many other people out there are facing similar situations. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to invite people to write in with comments on this story and maybe suggestions or maybe other stories. Our email address is otw@2600.com. The program is Off the Wall. We're on every week. And we'd sure like to hear what people have to think about American justice, where it's gotten to, how something like this could happen in the first place. Or maybe we're wrong here. Maybe you really are a criminal mastermind. Maybe I'm a criminal mastermind, too, and the likes of us should not be walking around influencing people. I don't know. Any final words, Lurid, to leave the audience with?
You know, yeah. The fact is that, and this is a sad fact, but something to keep in mind, that the world is a poop sandwich, and the more bread you have, the less poop you have to taste.
That's pretty genius, actually. Of course, probably poop isn't the word you would want to use, but yeah, that's...
Oh, absolutely not, but I was told to watch my language.
Yeah, well, of course, this is Radio Land. But listen, we're going to keep the folks updated on this story, and hopefully we can follow this over the years and see justice prevail. I sure would like to see that. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, best of luck.
Thanks.
This is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein. We'll see you next week.